From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea, bringing communities together.
There comes a time when we heed a certain call, when the world must come together as one.
Today we introduce you to several of Georgia's many different communities. A new documentary introduces us to the world's only transgender bodybuilding competition. It's held in Atlanta. Plus, how cities and towns in the state approach immigration enforcement very different ways. That's ahead, but first we want to hear from you. Do you know somebody who has been deported or who faces deportation? You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Georgia is, of course, a hub of multiculturalism, and students at Oglethorpe University in Atlanta are telling those stories through podcasts. It's all part of a class called Literary Tribalism, How to Read Race, Class, Nation, and Gender. This conversation that we're about to have about that class is part of our series, Lessons from Left Field, in which we learn about unusual courses of study around the state. Oglethorpe University professor Reshmi Hebbar joins us. She teaches this class. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Adam. It's good to be here.
Glad to have you. We're also joined by two of your students, Caleb Logan and Yasmin Tehrani. Morning to you guys.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So, Professor, where'd you come up with this idea for this course?
Well, the idea for the course touches on something you just said, multiculturalism. The idea was obviously to expose students to as many different cultural backgrounds, walks of life, something we call diversity, I suppose. The intersection of diversity and literature was the idea. And this is an idea that's been around in academia and universities for at least 20 or 30 years. I wanted to call it literary tribalism because I think that word brings to mind so many different things, and those different interpretations come to light in the classroom. For example, I think some students assume that tribes are self-chosen, that we choose to put ourselves in tribes, and that these are decisions that are sort of that we make. However, when we look at the works of literature that we study in the class, I'm hoping that what comes out is that there are real systemic issues, real systemic problems that continue to marginalize and displace populations and communities, not just in America, but around the world. The title, I have to give credit to a Nigerian author, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who has written several novels, most notably Americana. She wrote a piece about a classic American novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, 50 years after it was published. And as a Nigerian author, she went back and reread that text and said that you can see aspects of, quote, American tribalism in To Kill a Mockingbird, aspects of race, region, and class. And I think most of us who've read that novel, or most people, assume that, you know, there is no tribalism in that text. And so I start the class with that novel, and we look at the construction of whiteness. We sort of deconstruct that construction, and then we move on to two other white writers, Philip Roth and Eugene O'Neill, to examine and problematize, what do we mean by whiteness? What do we mean by blackness? What do we mean by Asianness as we move throughout the course?
So it sounds like a fascinating course that you're teaching at Oglethorpe University, and not one terribly unusual for an English department nowadays. I suppose what makes it really special is that rather than simply having your students perform work in the class in the form of papers, you're having them do podcasts. Where'd that idea come from?
Well, yes. I have always wanted to push my students to think about what literary studies and critical analysis can do for them after they leave my classroom and after they graduate. I think English gets a bad rap, that, you know, students are going to be left with just knowing how to read.
Right.
And so, as you mentioned, you know, we do write a couple of papers in this class, but the podcasting allows them to develop critical literacy skills, digital literacy skills, also to just think about what they've read through the course of the semester and see how those experiences that they're reading about in fiction may be mirrored in real lives in Atlanta. I really want to, you know, take them out of their box and out of their comfort zones and send them into the lab, into Atlanta, into the city, for them to figure out who's the best person to interview. What does that person have to say? And then I think most difficult for them is to cut down a 1 hour interview, you know, to 5 minutes or 6 minutes and think about adding sound layers to that. Basically, I tell them this is like, you know, the hardest essay probably that you might ever write. But when you record your own thoughts and your own reflections about the person you interviewed, that's just a really great transition that we would use in an essay.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more, based on what I do for a living. But Yasmeen and Caleb, do you feel like you've been taken out of your box?
Absolutely. I have very little idea what I was doing, but hats off to Dr. Hobar. She really walked us through that process. And really, once you found your subject, it kind of wrote itself a little bit. It was just then the editing it down and trying to pick what was most important.
Yeah, I think the problem of verbalizing such complex topics was definitely a difficult transition. I think with a paper, you have the space and the time to really just kind of hash out what words you want to use. But there's something spontaneous, I think, about these podcasts that really pushed all of us.
Well, Yasmeen, let's listen to the podcast that you made for the class in which you talked to a second-generation Iranian-American. And in this clip, she's going to talk about her struggles growing up in Atlanta. Let's hear it.
Okay.
For instance, when I'm here with my friends in Georgia State or wherever, I don't really feel like I can be completely connected with this American group because I will always be foreign in their eyes.
So, what was remarkable to you about that story, Yasmeen?
Well, firstly, I do on a personal note relate to that just because we do share the same background essentially. Mm-hmm. And I also think her remark about placelessness is a universal sense to feel, I think, for second generation diaspora here. And I also think her difficulty at reconciling her dual identity was a really interesting point of conversation, because I think even in just immediate day-to-day interactions, you're trying to meld these two identities together. So it's really interesting to hear how pervasive that difficulty is.
We are talking about a course that is taught at Oglethorpe University, just north of Atlanta. It's called Literary Tribalism, How to Read Race, Class, Nation, and Gender. This is part of a series that we do here on Second Thought, where we look at unusual courses being taught around the state. With us is the professor of that particular class, Reshmi Hebbar. Also with us are two of her students, Caleb Logan and and Yasmeen Tehrani. Reshmi, how did Yasmeen do?
She did really well. And actually, I was so glad she said what she just said in terms of her own cultural background, because one thing, Yasmeen was in my class last year, which was the first time I taught the course, and it was sort of a pilot year. One thing that I always noticed in class is Yasmeen is super participative and articulate, as I'm hoping that you could just tell with her response. She never talked about her cultural background in class, unlike all of my other students. And so I feel like the assignment, at least in some way, the podcast assignment allowed her to bring that academically to light. I didn't tell her to choose the subject that she chose, but I feel like it was probably a way for her to participate in the more experiential-based discussions going on in the class that I can't really stop sometimes. I really have a hard time derailing those. And she was able to reflect upon this, her subject, in a way that actually touched on her life, which I found to be very gratifying.
Caleb, your podcast is about a Guyanese woman who has her own struggles living in the United States. Let's hear a clip from that.
I'm Guyanese, but I appear to be Black, but I have a totally different upbringing than yourself or even my husband at that, even when it comes to as small as taking your shoes off at the door before walking into a house. You know, he wasn't taught that, but in my culture, that is definitely something that is, it's known.
That's interesting. Caleb, where'd you find your subject?
So she actually works at Oglethorpe University, and we are close friends. So it was really cool to get to hear that side of her story.
Anything in her experience resonate with your own?
Yeah. I think what really impacted me from that podcast was the idea of monoliths, even in reading through the class, I often thought of tribes as like these big monoliths that encompass everyone. And I think what she brought to light was there is value in having specificity even in that. Even though she is someone who would be encompassed under the idea of blackness, it's also important to identify her as a Caribbean woman and kind of really reckon what that means and not just look at her as this black woman without that Caribbean background.
Sure. Professor Habar, I imagine that as you were prepping your students to do this assignment, you had to do some interviewing training with them. I like to think that that's a special skill that can't just be done by anyone. And it's remarkable to me that an interview is itself always inevitably going to be a collision between two people of different or similar backgrounds, and those backgrounds are going to interact, perhaps just subtextually, over the course of the interview. Did you encourage them to be aware of what they were bringing to the table in terms of their own tribe and how their tribe might interact with the tribe of the person they were talking to?
Absolutely. They went armed with some sample questions about cultural background, but throughout the course, we would do these sort of 5 to 10 minute breaks from our texts of study and talk about cultural podcasts that are already out there. We did some listening to StoryCorps, and I would also give them exercises where I would ask them to sort of go out into the campus community and talk to someone, use their computer, record on Audacity, and then ask a follow-up question. Sometimes those were questions about texts that we were reading. Just to give you an example, we were reading a text called The Reluctant Fundamentalist by Mohsen Hamid, and I asked them to go find students, not show them the text, but ask them if they heard the title The Reluctant Fundamentalist, what would they think the text was about? And we got a whole range of answers. And so what I wanted to stress in that exercise is the follow-up question. How do you get something useful based on the follow-up question? And it was really interesting to see them think on their feet that way.
Let's try to listen to one more clip before we have to end this conversation. Another one of your students, Sam Kuttner, did a podcast on his dad. Let's listen to a clip from this.
They handed me a 40-gallon Texas hat, and they said, put this cowboy hat on, and remember, when you go out there, say, howdy, welcome to Pocos. And I said, I can't say howdy, okay? I'm not going to pass for howdy. Look at me. I'm an immigrant. I'm almost brown. I got this afro, which I did, okay? Do not tell me to say howdy. And they said, no, you have to say howdy. That's our policy.
So many intriguing elements in that. Reshmi, what'd you like about that assignment?
I absolutely loved Sam's podcast. That was his Pofolks story about his dad being forced to, I guess. I think it's a really nice way to think about sort of forced assimilation and the sort of cultural customs that we take for granted or that are imposed on us in being American sometimes. And if you were able to read Sam's rationale for his podcast, all students have to sort of debrief and write a rationale. He was very proud of capturing that moment of the Pofolk story, and he built the entire podcast around what that meant in terms of us versus them. So I was very proud of it.
That is Reshmi Habar. She is an assistant professor of English at Oglethorpe University. We're talking about her class there. We were also joined by her students, Caleb Logan and Yasmin Tirani. Great work, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Adam.
It was a pleasure.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. TransFitCon is the world's only transgender bodybuilding competition, and it's held in Atlanta. The competition is open to anyone who identifies as a transgender male, regardless of his physical appearance. A new documentary called Man Made follows the lives of 4 trans men as they prep their physiques and their psyches for TransFitCon. The film debuted recently at the Atlanta Film Festival, where it won Documentary Feature Jury Award. And filmmaker T. Cooper joins us. He wrote and directed the film. Hey, T.
Hey, how's it going?
Going all right. Also with us is one of the people that we see featured in your documentary, training for the competition. It's Reese Weaver. Good morning, Reese.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing all right. Let's start off with you, T. Wow, fascinating subject. How'd you come across it?
Yeah, well, I moved to Atlanta about 3 years ago, and I heard about this competition, and I was just as surprised as most people that it existed, and started looking into it. I'm a journalist and a writer by trade, so my first impulse was to write a story about it. And I pitched it to a couple publications, New York Times Magazine, places like that. They were super interested. But the minute I got into the story and started meeting these guys like Reese and Mason and learning their stories, I just immediately knew I had to turn this into a film and figure out a way to get a camera on my shoulder and do that.
Yeah. Well, bodybuilding makes for great footage. When I heard about the existence of your documentary and therefore learned about the competition, my reaction was not surprise. I was like, oh, that totally makes sense. That totally makes sense. Because transitioning from one sex to another is all about changing one's body through sheer force of will and sometimes surgery and pharmaceuticals. And that's kind of what bodybuilding is about generally. And also just a lot of the hormones that are used for sex reassignment therapies are the same hormones used by bodybuilders generally for their anabolic effect to help build muscles. Do I have that right, Reese?
Yeah, you have it correct.
I suppose it just makes all the sense in the world. The film follows four trans men's lives outside of the competition. There's Mason, Dominic, Reese, who's with us, and Kenny. Mason is one of the lightweight bodybuilders. Here is Mason talking about why he competes in these competitions.
Bodybuilding has meant a ton for me because it helped me transition and change my body before I could actually get on testosterone.
Interesting. So Reese, being one of the trans men in this film, why is bodybuilding important to you?
Bodybuilding is important to me because it's my passion. And it has nothing to do with my transition. And it has everything to do with just mentally. When I enter the gym, I just lift up the weight and everything in the world doesn't bother me. I don't have to worry about anything. I don't have to worry about what people think, and it's a very inspiring atmosphere.
Right. It's a yoga. It's a discipline. It's a way of focusing oneself.
Correct.
Unfortunately, though, in the film, we see that you trained for the show, and then you weren't able to attend because your flight got delayed. That must have been devastating.
Yeah, that was a complete bummer.
Yeah. Well, I think for people who don't know about this, you know, you can't just decide that you want to do one of these competitions and then a month later do it. How long were you prepping for this?
I took about 2 years because I had to lose a lot of body fat. Mm-hmm. And also you have to carve it. It's just like a canvas. You're making a work of art. So it takes time and effort and meal prepping. It's a long journey, basically. Yeah.
While you were filming the documentary, one of the subjects, Dominic, had what is called top surgery. For listeners who don't know what top surgery is, this is a procedure to create a male contoured chest. Specifically, it's a double mastectomy where you graft the nipple back on. Here is a clip of Dominic before he received his surgery.
I'm ready to just throw a shirt on and not have to, you know, readjust and be like, hold on a second, let me tuck in my binder, you know. I just want to be free, man.
Wow, T, what was it like to be a fly on the wall for that process and for the unveiling of that new physique after the surgery?
Yeah, well, it was obviously super powerful and emotional. What's so cool about it is that in the course of the film, we filmed at two FitCon competitions, and that's where I met Dominic, was at the first one. And that was pre-surgery. Obviously, he had, you know, had still breast tissue. And then he was going to have surgery and then train for the second competition. So to see such utter emotional, psychological, and also, of course, physical transformation was just super moving. And as, you know, a trans person myself who went through something similar, just to get to be in that intimate space with him and to be welcomed into that world was really moving. You know, I sat in that ER and filmed, mm-hmm. you know, a 6-7 hour surgery and then was with him for a week of recovery. So, you know, it was very intimate. And I think, you know, I think it shows up in the film.
Yeah. Yeah. On the one hand, it's incredible that you were able to get the kind of access that you needed in order to tell the story about these trans men preparing for bodybuilding competition. But on the other hand, I suppose just the very fact that they were doing what they were doing indicates that they were ready to let it all hang out, right? Like to compete in one of these competitions, you gotta strip down and just stand in front of a hall full of people and have every nook and cranny of your body scrutinized. So I suppose they were ready.
Yeah, that was actually one of the things that was most striking to me, was just what it takes to stand in front of people and be judged in literally like the skimpiest piece of material you've ever seen in your life, with just, you know, millimeters between all of you and the audience. So that's constantly surprising to me. I don't think I would ever do it, you know, no matter what I looked like. And so that was, yeah, I mean, it just takes a lot of, you know, nerve to do that. And it's impressive. And, you know, my hat was off to them all the time for not only letting me into their, you know, physical lives, but also their intimate and emotional lives.
Yeah. Reese, what's it like to stand up and do that?
For me, it's more about representing for people who haven't had top surgery, because I'm pre-op and I want people to know that it's okay to own your body, be proud of who you are. Everybody transitions differently in this process to these things, because everybody can't get surgery overnight. So when we had this opportunity and I heard about FitCon, I didn't hear about it till the second year, and it was something that I felt that I had to do, because I want to motivate other people to feel like it's okay to be a man and to not have top surgery.
Yeah, one of the really striking things we see in the film is the incredible diversity of the physiques that we see on that stage. We see people who, you know, you would, unless you knew that they were trans, you would never guess, right? And then other people in various stages of transition, and people who haven't transitioned at all, and everyone up there doing the same thing and being judged against one another. It was a really remarkable thing to see. We're speaking with T. Cooper, director and writer of the award-winning film Man Made. It's a documentary about the world's only transgender bodybuilding competition, which happens in Atlanta. And the film also recently premiered in Atlanta at the Atlanta Film Festival, where it won a big award. Also with us is one of the subjects of the film, Reese Weaver. Let's listen to one more clip here. In the documentary, after Mason competes in a competition in which he does not disclose being transgender, his sister says this.
I think the intricacies of bodybuilding appeal to the control and getting to the place where, you know, he's literally his own man.
T, do you think she has it right there?
Yeah, 100%. And you can see it in his face and his body and just the way he carries himself, that, you know, he comes into himself when he's on stage. And it's not about being macho. It's not about being some super, like, roided out Hulk dude. You know, this is his life, and this is how he is the best man for himself, for his wife, for his family, for his eventual children. It's just really beautiful.
Sure. But you said the R word there, roids. What role do we see drugs playing in this film?
To be honest, it's an issue that has not really been taken on in the bodybuilding world, because none of these guys is taking any more testosterone than the average cisgender or non-trans man. Mm-hmm. As Mason even says in the film, you know, he hasn't been on testosterone as long as the rest of the guys that he's competing against. And of course, we're talking about not trans FitCon, but other mainstream bodybuilding competitions. And, you know, in a way, he's playing catch up. There's no doping at all. He's getting his levels where everybody else's are. So, you know, I obviously bodybuilding is rife with that. Yeah. But you know, these guys, I don't think we didn't get into super much of that, because they're just taking, you know, hormone replacement therapy to get to where they need to be to live their lives.
Yeah, I suppose it's a less fraught subject in this particular area of bodybuilding than it is in bodybuilding generally, because so many of the cisgendered pro bodybuilders out there are probably getting their anabolic drugs illegally, whereas I imagine a lot of the folks featured in your film are prescribed them as part of their hormone as part of their sex reassignment therapies. And that ironically makes it a less fraught topic, which is, one of the 10 million super interesting dimensions about this story that you stumbled upon, T. And I'm so glad that you were able to tell it in your film. Enough with the bodybuilding geekery, and let's talk about some other dimensions that are touched on in the film, simply the life of being a trans person. Reese, in this film, we see that you have a son, Demonte, and in the movie, he addresses you as mommy. Have you talked to him about calling you daddy, or do you care?
This is an issue, a question that I always come across with everyone who does an interview with me.
Sure.
And I just want the world to know that my son is my son, and whatever he chooses to identify me as, mother, father, it doesn't matter. He's my child. He's my seed. I love him. Mm-hmm. And so often in society, we get caught up in mother, father, you know, stuff like that. It shouldn't matter. As long as your child loves you, it doesn't matter what he calls me. And I'm biologically his mother, and he knows this, and he's exposed to the trans community, and he knows that I'm trans, but I'm his mother at the end of the day.
We see, though, in the film, you, Reese, encountering problems that are unique to the trans community. We see that you were homeless for a while, and you couldn't find anywhere to stay because Atlanta didn't offer homeless shelters that were safe and inviting to trans people. What was that experience like?
It was a very terrible experience. I felt very dysphoric. I felt very depressed. I felt less than. I thought, how could an animal get shelter and food and water, but me, a trans man, I'm denied human necessities of living?
So what's a solution to that problem that the cities and states could be thinking about?
To allow trans individuals to have housing. I mean, we're no different from anyone else. We're human. We bleed the same as anyone else. So why can't we have housing? If we identify as male, why can't we be put on the male side? If we identify as female, why can't we be put there?
T. Cooper, when you were making this film, what were the other sort of non-bodybuilding things that we see going on in this movie that really struck you?
Well, you know, as again, as a trans person, I just don't feel like I saw my stories, especially trans male stories, represented on screen. And so for me, the approach was always, yeah, bodybuilding. That's super interesting and all. And we're building toward that as a structure. But really, it was the 360-degree nature of these guys' lives and the things that they went through that are just universal. I mean, finding where you come from, you know, meeting a biological parent, breakups, makeups, job stuff, wife stuff, you know, the homelessness, the violence that Reese and his partner Tia's friend encountered in Baltimore, you know, violence against trans people. But also, you know, just fatherhood, motherhood. I mean, it's all in there. It's all there's a little bit of something for everybody. And it was very important for me to show the richness of these lives and the texture that is there while they are, you know, working on this external stuff. There's also all this internal stuff that's always going on. And of course, the metaphor of bodybuilding and turning yourself into the person that you want to be. I mean, we all do that. We all, as humans, the minute we're born to the minute we leave, we are changing, we're adapting, we're growing, we're changing. And you know, that affects those around us and ourselves. So that was always going to be the focus. You know, they could have been ice boat fishermen up in Alaska.
Reese, as T mentioned there, one of the things that we see in the film is that one of you and your wife's friends, Crystal, was shot and killed in Baltimore for disclosing that she was a trans woman, and she was also African-American. Being an activist in the trans community, what would you say are some of the particular dimensions of being a person of color who is trans?
It's very hard, and I feel like so often murders go unsolved. They don't try to solve them, and I feel like we're less than. And I just don't understand it. We're just people trying to live our lives, and it's just like we can't.
So in the last minute that we've got here, let's see if we can drum up some business for TransFitCon the next time it's held in Atlanta. T, if somebody were to show up to this event, what would they experience?
You know, it's a little bit of inside bodybuilding, inside trans life. It's, you know, there's a lot more than just the competition. I don't know the details of what's coming up with the next one, but mm-hmm. if it goes according to plan, I think there will be seminars, and I hope that we will be showing man-made the bodybuilding, you know, the film there at the competition. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, it's like a space for a bunch of different people of different experiences, ages, sizes, stages of transition to get together and share and, you know, celebrate and be celebrated.
Reese, I know that you identify more as of a power lifter than a bodybuilder. The distinction being powerlifting is about competing who can lift the most weight, as opposed to bodybuilding, which is about how your body looks. Do you think that you are going to try to compete in a bodybuilding show again, though?
No, I did bodybuilding to just encourage other people who were pre-op to come out there and try it, and I tried it. And I feel like I'm taking my journey elsewhere, and powerlifting is where I want to be, and I'm trying to conquer that, and I plan to be the first trans man, world's strongest man, and that's my goal right now. That's what I'm focusing on.
Cool. That is Reese Weaver. He's featured in the documentary Man Made about the world's only transgender bodybuilding competition, which happens in Atlanta. The film was made by T. Cooper, who also joined us. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. It's National Historic Preservation Month. Every theater tells a story as dramatic as anything to appear on stage. Tomorrow, we visit Macon's Douglas Theater. It was an important space during the 20th century for African-American artists. It hosted performers like Bessie Smith, Little Richard, Otis Redding. We'll dive into that history tomorrow. Is there a historic landmark in your community that we should know about? You can call us at 404-594-57, or you can find us on Twitter and Facebook, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Local authorities do not have to collaborate with federal immigration enforcement if they don't want to. Athens-Clark County recently joined the list of at least 8 Georgia communities that now refuse to honor ICE detainers. That's when Immigration and Customs Enforcement asks local jails to hold people that they've booked until ICE agents can come and get them. It's a different story elsewhere in Georgia. Many cities and counties eagerly cooperate with ICE. Here's a story from one such place. On a recent morning, a woman got up in her predominantly Latino neighborhood outside of Warner Robins and drove to work. Then, she says, she noticed a Houston County Sheriff's deputy parked nearby. He was waiting, she says. That is her voice, though we've altered it to hide her identity at her request. She says that she was only going a mile or two over the speed limit, but the deputy tailed her anyway.
He continued following me as if he were checking me until we reached the stop. There, he turned on the siren. At that moment, I thought, this is it.
Possibly the beginning of the end of 15 years living in the United States. The deputy asked for her license, and like many people living in the country illegally, she did not have one. When she got to the Houston County Jail, the staff there did what they've been doing routinely since 2009, scanned her fingerprints and sent them to ICE. Word came back from the feds, hold her until we can come get her, which they did. Then she spent more than 3 weeks in ICE's Irwin County Detention Center in South Georgia. She's out now on $10,000 bail, awaiting her day in immigration court. The woman says none of this would surprise anyone like her who has dealt with law enforcement in Houston County.
The majority just see you're Latino and they stop you.
I emphatically deny.
Denying it is Houston County Chief Deputy Billy Rape. He says that his department does not target people like this woman. He says they're just enforcing basic public safety laws, and it's only by chance that they pull over people who have immigration issues. Indeed, the deputy who arrested this woman said in his report that she was driving far faster than she now claims.
Are all illegals murderers, rapists, drug users, drug dealers? No. So that's why we don't make the decision to turn them over to ICE or not. We let ICE tell us, do you need this person?
And ICE typically says yes. But curiously, ICE hasn't wanted to pick up nearly as many people arrested in neighboring Macon-Bibb County, a community with a similar population. County and city law enforcement in Houston arrest people with alleged immigration violations at a rate 4 times that of Macon-Bibb County. Bibb Sheriff David Davis says going too far to help ICE enforce immigration law would make his job harder to do by damaging trust with local immigrant communities.
If they're worried about getting arrested and sent away simply because they've overstayed a visa, they're not going to tell you about the drug seller that's living 2 doors down from them. I want that drug seller.
Now, the Trump administration may not share Davis's philosophy. It has reordered ICE's priorities, and now more people who've committed minor, nonviolent crimes are facing possible deportation, crimes like driving without a license. Now, I reported that story with my journalism students at Mercer University, including Vanessa Alva, whom you heard there, doing the translations. For a deeper version of that story, go to gpbnews.org. But for now, let me welcome Vanessa to talk a little bit more about what we found out and how people in our part of the state have been reacting to our reporting. Hey, Vanessa.
Hi, Adam.
So, Vanessa, we had to do a lot of work in order to gather the raw information that we needed in order to report the conclusions that we just laid out. Tell people about what we had to do to get all these records.
So at the beginning of the class, we were working on several investigative reporting projects, and Adam suggested what we wanted to work on, and the class voted on one of those stories to be immigration in Houston County. So what we did is we compiled a list of police reports that we requested from Houston County Police Department, and we created spreadsheets looking at those police reports on people who had been detained for ICE, and we looked at what kind of infractions they had been held for. Some of those were violent, such as domestic violence, but about half of them were for traffic violations, such as not turning on a turn signal or following too closely, not stopping at a stop sign, or just minor traffic infractions like that. Then we went and followed up on some of those police reports to find people we could talk to.
I gave you a really hard assignment, which was just to like look at these police reports and go to the addresses of these people who were arrested in part for immigration violations in Houston County and see if you can get any of them to talk, people who would quite naturally be very reticent to talk. Tell people about that experience.
So we called some of the numbers that were on the police reports, and a lot of those numbers were obviously disconnected because those people had either been still in the ICE detention or they had been deported. But we did get one number that it continued ringing, so we assumed that either a family member still had access to that phone. So we went to that address, which is the address of the woman that we interviewed. Nobody was there when we got there, but we spoke to a neighbor, and she actually told us that she had been released. So we waited there for a little bit, but then she told us that they weren't going to be there until really late in the evening. So we left, and we continued pursuing other addresses, but nobody would talk to us. They either said they didn't know who we were talking about, or they just didn't feel comfortable speaking with us, which is completely normal. And then we went back to the address just to see if maybe we got lucky, and we did. The woman was actually getting off work at that time, and she was coming into her home, so we approached her, and she welcomed us into her home, and we were able to interview her that way.
I'm speaking with Vanessa Alva. She was a student in my investigative reporting class at Mercer University in this spring semester that just ended. And she and I and her classmates worked on an investigative report looking at immigration enforcement practices in Houston County, which is where Warner Robins is, just south of Macon. And based on the numbers that we were able to assemble, it sure looks like the Houston County law enforcement community is doing some kind of targeting of immigrant communities there, though they vehemently deny it. But they're just arresting people with immigration violations at a rate far higher than comparable communities. And that's what we reported. Vanessa, you yourself are a Mexican immigrant. Tell people about your background.
So I was born in Mexico. I came to the United States when I was 3 years old. My father was able to become a legalized permanent resident through the Ronald Reagan amnesty. So mm-hmm. we were privileged enough to be able to become legal through that way. It's not really easy for people to become legalized. You either have to have a family member do it through a working company or something, and through some excruciating circumstances. So I recognize that my ability to become a permanent resident was not the norm, because not everybody has access to do it that way.
And surely your background and your language skills in Spanish, this must have helped you a lot as you were going down to Houston County trying to get people like that woman we heard from to talk to you.
Yes. So the neighbor that we spoke to, for example, she spoke Spanish, and the people that we interviewed, everybody that we encountered seeking out these interviews, everybody spoke Spanish. So it definitely made it a lot easier to be able to communicate with people. And I think it made them feel also a little more comfortable speaking to someone that looked like them, because I'm not sure if that would have been the case if it had been somebody else.
Yeah. Let's talk about the reaction that we've seen to this reporting that we put out into the world starting on Sunday in the Macon Telegraph. A lot of comments from people reacting to the headline. I think the headline in the Telegraph was something along the lines of Houston County number one in immigration enforcement in Middle Georgia. And lots of people commented on that piece saying, good. Way to go, Houston County. One person commented, why would these people be in the country illegally anyway? They have to get in line just like at Ellis Island, is what one person said. It doesn't work like that now, right? I mean, citizenship is a much more difficult and complex thing to try to get.
It definitely is, and I don't think a lot of people are necessarily aware of the cost, the time it takes. There's like a lot of that goes into how you become legal in this country, and I don't think a lot of people are necessarily aware of that.
Based upon your assessment, how common is the kind of coverage that we did about immigration detentions in Middle Georgia?
I don't think that it's that common compared to cities like Atlanta, where immigration does play a bigger focus. I think that oftentimes Middle Georgia, specifically the news that I've seen, doesn't really cover immigration as much as Atlanta does. So I think that that might have allowed for the conditions to continue as much as they have. I mean, a lot of the people that we spoke to said that this has been going on since the Bush era. So I think that because there might be a lack of reporting, there might be a lack of response to what has been going on in Houston County.
What else do you want to look at with your reporting, Vanessa, in terms of immigration in Georgia?
Based on a lot of the comments, a lot of people were concerned that there are people driving without licenses. So potentially next year, as a part of more reporting on immigration, I'd like to look into whether Georgia legislators would be open to giving licenses to people that are undocumented. There are other states that practice this, such as California and Colorado. And maybe that would make the jobs of a lot of these police officers easier. And a lot of the people that feel uncomfortable with people driving without licenses might be put at rest.
That was Mercer University student journalist Vanessa Alva. The article that she reported with me and the class that I taught this past spring semester, which is about immigration detentions in Middle Georgia, was published Sunday in the Telegraph newspaper in Macon. You can also find it published in full on gpbnews.org. Vanessa, it was such a privilege working with you on this. You did such a great job, and thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
This year's NPR Tiny Desk Contest winner is Naya Izumi from Columbus, Georgia. He started playing guitar at around 8 years old, and he's also on the autism spectrum. On Second Thoughts, LaRaven Taylor talked with Izumi about his music and his mission to make what he calls declarative music.
My name is Naya Izumi, and I'm a musician from Columbus, Georgia. Now in Los Angeles, and I am the winner of the NPR Tiny Desk Contest. My dad was in the Army. I grew up pretty poor family. You know, we lived on base in Fort Benning, and then we lived in the trailer park, and then we moved around a lot. My dad, he was really rough on me, but I kind of dealing with autism and whatnot, which at the time the diagnosis did not exist, so it was a little bit extra rough because there was no really understanding of what was going on with me, why I was so slow socially. So I had a very difficult time in school. I literally failed the first grade and no, it was actually kindergarten. That was what I failed. And it was tough. And, you know, I wouldn't say I found music. It was kind of just there, and I grabbed onto it. And I'd never let go of it ever since. It's been my shoulder to cry on. It's been my only friend when friends were shady. That's pretty much my life. Soft-spoken, it was inspired by a altercation I got in with somebody that I was working with, and I was just, you know, I was kind of frustrated because I'm a very soft-spoken person, and a lot of times soft-spoken people would kind of get stepped over a lot of times and talked over and just And even some of us know what we want, and you know, we have an expertise about what we're doing, but you know, it happens. And I was just like, I'm gonna write a song about this. This could be a good song. So that was that.
Don't judge, baby. A book by its cover.
It was soft-spoken woman, but I changed it to soft-spoken because I wanted to make it more broad, more something that, because it's not just women that deal with this, it's people, it's a people problem.
Nobody's got it the way she does, simply magic.
I mean, as in, she doesn't exist in my life at the moment that I wrote it, kind of thing. But it would be nice to feel that way about someone and to actually, you know, have it be the truth. Since winning the contest after the tour and all that stuff, I'm focusing on continuing my goals of winning a couple Grammys and playing Royal Albert Hall and trying to get into all the nicest venues around the world.
That was Naya Izumi, NPR's 2018 Tiny Desk Contest winner. The two songs that you just heard are Soft Spoken and Voodoo. Izumi is from Columbus, Georgia, and now lives in Los Angeles. And that's it for our show today, but as always, we want to hear from you. Who are your favorite Georgia artists? Give us a call at 404-500-9457, or you can post on Twitter or Facebook. We're at OST Talk. Our show is produced by Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is the senior producer. Don Smith edits the show, and Tanya Ott is the executive producer. The engineer is Tyler Morris. Special thanks to the interns, Emmanuel Johnson, Emily Bunker, and Reed Williams. The theme music is Silent Machine by Georgia's own Cat Power. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.